Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the head of North American Specialty Lending at HPS. This gentleman graduated from Wharton undergrad before moving to New York to start his career in finance. He spent about 5 years at BlackRock, first at BlackRock proper, before moving over to BlackRock Kelso, a BDC focused on specialty direct lending. In 2010, he joined then Highbridge to work in the growing direct lending business of the Highbridge Principal Strategies Group, the business that later became HPS when separating from JP Morgan in 2016. He spent over a decade at HPS and has been instrumental in the growth and success of HPS's specialty lending business over that time. He and I sit a short distance from each other in the office, and I consider him a truly gifted investor and manager, as well as a friend, and he's someone who I'm proud to call partner. So without any further ado, I'm very excited to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Vikas Keswani, head of North American Specialty Lending. Vikas, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Colbert. You're too kind. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, let's go all the way back. People know I like to start from the beginning. Where'd you grow up, Vikas? Where are you from originally?
It's a somewhat surprising answer, I think. I was born in Taipei, Taiwan, and then a year into my life, my parents moved me to Japan. It was a sort of disruptive period in our lives in that my grandparents are ethnically Indian, and they were in India during independence. And in that diaspora, if you will, my dad moved around a lot, ultimately to Japan. And that's where I spent most of my life, my formative years at least, in a small town, Kobe. Very famous for its beef.
We'll get to this at some point, I'm sure, but you're a good foodie and a gourmand, so maybe that's where it all started. If you grew up in Kobe, you sort of have to be. So Vikas, you start college at Tufts in the U.S. and they make the decision to move over to Wharton. Tell me about your college decisions and how that all played out.
Sure. And again, applying from a small town in Japan, we didn't really have that much exposure. We were able to look at American universities through catalogs really more than anything else. So I skipped the more common college tours. And also just in terms of my academic interests at the time, they're really around the sciences. I really enjoyed chemistry, physics, mathematics. And so I initially thought I would pursue a degree in engineering, and that's what took me to Tufts. I was there as an engineer. Very quickly, I realized that engineering was not just physics, chemistry, and mathematics, but you started to have to pick a field specifically, a career path, and nothing really struck me as particularly interesting. Meanwhile, I was more exposed to things in the business environment, and that really took me. And as a result, I decided to transfer out. And I transferred to Wharton for that reason, really, to pivot from an engineering course more toward commerce, business, finance, that sort of thing.
All right. So you graduate, you start your career at BlackRock in New York. Tell me about how that opportunity came about.
Yeah. So I did a summer investment banking. That was very common, I presume, for you and others who ended up in our business. And it was actually not a very good experience. It was in 2003. You'll recall at this time, the economy was quite weak. Most of what we were doing was pitching, not a lot of live transactions. The people I worked with at that particular bank didn't necessarily provide the best possible experience. And so my summer sort of burned me from investment banking. And so I pivoted and I was fortunate to be able to meet with folks at BlackRock and instantly felt like it would be a great place to start my career. I think a lot of folks know BlackRock is a large institution today, a meaningful player in asset management. But back then, in 2003, it was a small business. It was minority owned by PNC. Larry Fink, the CEO, would go to the morning meetings and I, as an intern, would sit right near him. You know, it was that kind of place. And I met some fantastic people who mentored me.
And tell me what your first job was there. What was the actual first role?
Yeah, I was an analyst, and it's funny that these were a combined group, international and alternatives. So you'll note that alternatives was very nascent back then. This was just the period where hedge funds were starting up a little bit. And this idea that alternatives would be an asset class on its own was still a debate. And so it was sprung out of the international group at BlackRock where I sat. And so I had exposure to both businesses, again, in a very early time for those businesses in terms of nascency.
And when you say alternatives, what did that mean there? Like, what did that actually cover?
Sort of anything outside of regular way equities and fixed income. You know, the world was just different. Everyone was focused on those asset classes and everything else from real estate to hedge funds to illiquid investments to CLOs was sort of an alternative at that point in time. Obviously, that is very different today.
So you mentioned the time. It's 2003. It's post the internet bubble burst. It's a choppy time in the markets. I always feel like somebody's first job shapes your perspectives. Tell me your lessons you remember from your early days at BlackRock.
I think the running lesson through my career, through the last 19 years, if you will, has been the people you work with matter. I worked with a gentleman by the name of Richard Cashel, who now is on the management committee of BlackRock. And he not only took me under his wing and exposed me in a lot of ways, he also helped me more personally. And, you know, that's the running lesson, less the environment and more the people you work with, I think.
So after a couple of years, you make the decision to move over to BlackRock Kelso. Tell me about how that came about and the appeal of that credit investing seed.
Yeah. So at that time, direct lending wasn't a thing. This idea that banks don't lend and others will step in wasn't really an idea people pursued. It was more, hey, there's smaller businesses that do $5-10 million in revenue, a couple million dollars in EBITDA, they'll need capital. Maybe there's something to do, without any idea as to how large the asset class would become. And as part of that sort of seed of an idea, we partnered with private equity firm Kelso, and I was part of that founding team to put this business together. We constructed it by way of a business development company, which is a 1940 Act vehicle. There were two others at the time that were public. Apollo had one and Ares had one. And it was really in their likeness that we built out BlackRock Kelso Capital.
So when you stepped in the door, as you said, it was sort of this funky group that had a pretty broad remit. You then make the decision to focus on the credit side. What was it about credit investing in particular that was a draw?
I really enjoyed doing what you've probably heard me say often and describe as deep dive due diligence, really understanding the nuts and bolts of a company, appreciating a strategy and projecting future cash flows. That sort of analysis always sat well with me. I was less oriented around being in front of a computer screen, watching valuations move dramatically and reacting to them. That was less my personality. I considered a career in private equity, which obviously is a very attractive career to have. But what turned me away from that was the idea that you'd be spending more time with fewer investments, getting involved with management, the board, compensation, corporate governance, tuck-in acquisitions, getting even deeper into these businesses. Whereas I really enjoyed doing the due diligence, but I wanted to see hundreds of companies, not a couple a year. And the thing about credit is it does afford that. You get to be real deep on these businesses, but you're not controlling them. And it was a good balance for me, again, of that sort of deep dive due diligence, but seeing a lot, satisfying my curiosity around business models.
All right. So you're a couple of years in that seat in a credit investment fund and a long-only product, obviously, the way BDCs work. 2008-2009 happens. The world falls apart in the global financial crisis. Tell me what you remember most from that experience.
Yeah, it was messy. We invested all of that capital, and I'll be pretty direct. We made a bunch of mistakes. We even took the vehicle public. So it's actually still publicly listed, by the way. And 2008-2009 happens and it's messy. The portfolio has a bunch of cracks. You learn, and this may be a running theme in today's environment, you learn about documentation mistakes you may have made. And with a public BDC, that messiness is quite real in that you can see the market tell you exactly what they think about your portfolio. And that's a really humbling experience.
Okay, so the world recovers. 2010, you come over to HPS just a couple of years after the business had been started by our CEO, Scott Kapnick. Tell me about the appeal of that opportunity. Like, what was the first pitch you heard?
Yeah, I met Mike in London.
Mike Tatterson, former HPS cast guest.
Yeah, so I meet him in London and we talk about the fact that there aren't necessarily a lot of people at this time who have tremendous amounts of experience in direct lending. And I brought that to the table. The idea that like I had been investing in loans since 2004 was rare. Of course, the market was quite different in its size and scope. So I think he found that particularly interesting. What I found particularly interesting about the opportunity, it goes back to the comment I made earlier around the running theme in my career, which is people. I enjoyed interacting with Mike. It was less a pitch and more getting to know each other. And I very quickly came to the conclusion that he's someone I could work with, learn from, and view as sort of the next mentor in my career.
So 2010, quite early in HPS's development, I mean, it had been around for like 18, 24 months at that point. Tell us the firm you joined at that point. What was HPS back then?
It was small in terms of people. I mean, I took a pay cut to come over. Like we were still scrambling for resources. The idea that the business would grow the way it did was not obvious to anybody at the time. And the view was we're going to roll up our sleeves and try to figure this sort of lending thing out. It really was a head down, sleeves up strategy. I mean, we were just going to figure it out.
Well, as you say, takes a bit of a leap of faith at the time. I mean, one that paid off relative to the trajectory, but was not immediately obvious, I imagine. Okay, so the firm has grown over those last 12 years. Direct lending, as you said, has become an asset class rivaling the size of levered loans. Within direct lending as an asset class at HPS, we divide it into what we call SLF, specialty loan finance, and core senior lending, CSL. What is SLF and what does it do?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is to compare and contrast core senior lending with specialty lending. I think there are a couple of ways to categorize it. I like to think about it one way, which is there's the flow beta business. We're setting up a benchmark of private credit loans, and that's the core senior loan business. And then there's the more alpha oriented, where extracting particularly high risk adjusted returns in sort of that specialty lending business. That's one way to think about it. The other way is a process. Core senior lending tends to be a little bit more oriented around sponsors. There's a little bit more of a flow to it in terms of process. Whereas specialty lending, I'll quote Mike, every loan is its own unique snowflake. You got to do the diligence separately, figure it out. There's a lot more involved with it. You tend not to have very organized counterparts in terms of information. A lot of times we're doing the work a private equity firm would do in terms of conducting diligence through third parties, procuring quality of earnings reports, those sorts of things. And then there's also the sort of speed, certainty, confidentiality type reasons that people will overpay you for risk. So it's a wide variety of reasons why one loan may be special versus core. But directionally, the way I would describe it is beta and alpha.
Makes total sense. We'll come to more current volatile credit markets that we're in right now. But in a normal functioning credit market, why would a borrower opt for a direct lending solution versus more traditional broadly syndicated world?
Yeah, I think the history of this is quite interesting. So as a result of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, which was obviously substantive, banking regulation evolved quite dramatically. And the result of that is banks moved almost entirely into a distribution model. Historically, and you'll recall in our conversation, we talked about how small the direct lending market was pre-crisis. The reason for that is banks would hold risk. They would actually lend money as definitionally a bank should. Post-crisis, they did much less of that. Colloquially, people talk about it as a moving versus a storage business, and banks decided that all they were going to do is move risk around. And what that means for a counterparty is there's less certainty. And why is there less certainty? Well, a bank will describe to a borrower what they expect to achieve in the marketplace, but then go out and syndicate that risk or spread it around. And in that process, pricing can change, terms can change, volatility in the markets can impact a lot of this. And as a result, execution is a little bit more uncertain. As a result of that, I think borrowers have seen that direct lending can be an interesting alternative. You're getting certainty. You're working with a counterparty who presumably keeps your information confidential, a counterparty who understands your business, and who you can actually view as a partner for growth rather than a loan that's been spread around the world by a bank.
So those are the reasons why somebody might pick the direct lending route. Are there disadvantages for borrow to the direct lending route? What are deals that make sense still in the broadly syndicated world?
Yeah. If you as a borrower want the best possible terms from a credit agreement perspective or documentation perspective, such that you would like to take advantage of your counterpart, direct lending is not for you. Presumably, direct lenders are focused on that. It's more of a partnership and less of a transaction. The other sort of element of the public broadly syndicated marketplace that I think borrowers like is it's liquid.
So if you look at like Preqin's, they would suggest that direct lending and private credit is sort of $1.2 trillion asset class today. So it's quite robust. How does HPS's SLF business then differentiate itself in that crowded field?
Yeah, we've been doing this since 2010. And when you look actually at the investments we've made over that sort of 12-year period, we've stuck to our knitting in a lot of ways. But one thing that has changed quite dramatically is size. There are only a handful of players in that space. They tend to be a lot more rational, a lot less competitive. And it's counterintuitive, but in the larger end of the market, you're lending to bigger companies, which as a result means less risk. They have reasons to exist and the like. There are buyers for these businesses. But the economic terms of these loans tend to be very similar to smaller loans. And you hear often in the investment business that scale is an enemy to success. That doesn't seem to be the case at all in the direct lending world. In fact, I would suggest that over our experience, what we've learned is being large is the place we want to be. So that's what you will see, you know, us do and continue to do.
So Vikas, we're recording this in the fall of 2022. You know, we've seen rates rise for the first time in a very long time. Inflation's ubiquitous. Banks have pulled back on lending. That sort of choppy environment, what does that environment mean for direct lending?
This is probably the most interesting environment to be a direct lending investor that we've seen, certainly since 2008-09. And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is, traditionally, we do compete with the syndicated markets. On the best day, the syndicated markets can price better and be competitive. Those markets are closed. Banks have taken on more risk than they should given the environment. They are still holding loans that they are having difficulty syndicating. And then what's worse is public single B loans, which is a good proxy for how to think about direct lending, are trading at prices between 91 and 92 cents on the dollar. It's very hard to issue new paper when the market's trading at 91, 92 without offering those kinds of discounts, which become obviously very unappealing for borrowers. So you've got, in short, a shut bank market. Then you pivot and look at the private sort of direct lending marketplace, and capital is scarce. There are less people being aggressive in this marketplace, less people who are suggesting they can hold $500, $600, $700, $800 million in size in a particular deal. This creates a unique environment for us. I think the idea that base rates, which in our world are either SOFR or LIBOR, are north of 4% today, and spreads are somewhere between 675 and 750, suggests that you can get 11 to 13% yields for first lien loans at loan to values of 40 to 45%. That is unprecedented.
Extraordinarily unusual in our careers. That's right. How different is what's happening right now? You mentioned the comparison to 2008-09. How is this different than what happened in the global financial crisis days?
Yeah. People are still transacting, and that is fascinating. You haven't seen valuations compress as much as you would expect them to, given the stress in the financing markets. I'm not sure that will last.
You and I had this debate the other day, right? That is the question. But, you know, how long? We'll see.
Yeah.
So tell me about the future then. Let's put in our crystal ball, not about what's going to happen and how quickly this all resolves itself, but like what gets you excited about direct lending in the coming years?
I think the next 6-12 months, however long this lasts, will be one where you'll see a little bit of a shakeout like we did in 2008-09, and I'll throw myself in that camp. People made mistakes, and that doesn't really come to light until you've got some stress in the marketplace, and here we are. And so I think that will be interesting. Over the last decade, you've just seen a number of direct lending firms prop up all over the place. I think that will start to shake out a little bit. You'll have fewer but larger players. This obviously has happened to the private equity industry. In the early 80s, there were tons of private equity firms. Now, more recently, you've got a handful of very large ones. I think you'll see the same thing happen to the direct lending landscape. I think that'll be really, really interesting to watch. And then I think just in terms of the asset class itself, I think there's no longer a debate, which there used to be, of whether direct lending is here to stay and whether it's, you know, a professional institutional asset class. It used to be viewed as strange if a borrower utilized a direct loan or private credit deal in 2011.
Yeah, there was like a stigma. What's wrong with you? Yeah,
exactly. No, why would you do that? Why did you need to do that? I do think that is going/gone and will continue to sort of be more mainstream.
No, it makes total sense. Exciting stuff, VK. Let me zoom back on you then for a second. I always am interested in sort of time management and how people handle themselves. You sit on multiple investment committees, but you get involved in day-to-day on deals, in particular where you've got domain expertise or close relationships. How do you manage your time? You've got these competing responsibilities, portfolio management, new deals, reviewing others. How do you think about managing all that?
Early in my career, I think I was more front-footed on what I would do with my time. I would decide, I'd wake up in the morning and view my day and plan it that way. I think that has gone out the window. I come to work now reacting more than anything. And what I mean by that is figuring out where I can be most helpful rather than dictating where I will be most helpful. I try to spend my day thinking about where I'd be most helpful. Sometimes that is jumping in on a deal and actually working through a due diligence question. Sometimes it is negotiating with a counterparty that's particularly difficult and would like some more support from HPS in terms of representation. And then sometimes it's meeting with investors. So it does range and vary. It is no longer predictable. I will admit that makes it really, really fun.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's back to your original decision on credit versus equity. Our jobs are, by definition, we're dealing with a bunch of different things, bunch of different credits at the same time. And there's something really fun about that. I think it keeps your mind active. Okay, well, before we move to the last segment of the podcast, Vikas, I'd like to do a speed round of questions with you. So I'm going to give you a simple question. First thought, best thought. You ready?
Let's do it.
All right. You can only eat one cuisine for the rest of your life. What do you pick?
Easy, Japanese.
I knew you'd say that. Favorite restaurant in New York City?
Le Bernardin.
Oh, it's so good. Favorite style of wine?
Ooh. Right now, Spanish, Rioja, and Ribera del Duro.
Great answer. Last great book you read?
Can I say what I'm reading right now?
Sure.
Secret Temple. It's a history about the Federal Reserve. Very apt for today.
I've been timely. Favorite vacation destination?
Ooh, Hawaii.
What is the place that you've never been to in the globe that you can't wait to go to?
Australia and Africa. I know those are big continents, but
yeah,
yes.
But they're far away. Our colleague, Gary Stead, former HPS guest, was in town who runs our Australia office, and I was trying to pitch him on it. It's very important that I go down there and see it.
Exactly. We'll do it together, Colbert.
Exactly. You know, you've got children, you've got obligations. So I'm going to give you a free Saturday afternoon to yourself. What are you doing for fun?
Something outdoors, either biking, kayaking, tennis, that sort of thing. You know, COVID left me with that realization that I don't do enough of it, and I am trying to do a lot more of it now.
All right, great. Good answers all around. With that, let's move to the last segment of the podcast. This is something we like to call Best Ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. We call it Best Ideas because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Vikas, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
You won't be surprised to know that I prepared for this. I did look at prior podcast guests and what they suggested, and all of them were along the lines, I think, more personal, restaurants, books. So I'm actually going to keep it quite serious and do something that's more related to my day-to-day focus here at HPS, which is what do I think is the most compelling / interesting opportunity set? And I think that is NAV lending. For those who are less familiar with that, it's the idea that private equity firms are going to face compressing valuations, they are facing high cost of capital financing, and there's earnings volatility as we talk about recessions. I do expect more and more private equity firms or owners of assets to borrow against their portfolios, hold on for the upside as there may be while getting financing now to realize cash flows or distributions. I think that's going to be the next big thing in terms of financing.
Fantastic. Great idea and a best idea. I love it. I'm going to go, I like to be inspired, as people know, for my recommendations by the guest of the week. And Vikas mentioned he's of Indian descent and mentioned sort of empire. And it triggered for me one that I think is actually a great recommendation. It's a follow-up to a previous best idea. I recommend a book, I think it was in season one or season two, The Anarchy by William Dalrymple, that's about the history of the British East India Company. He has a new podcast that I highly recommend called Empire. It's hosted by William Dalrymple, who wrote that book, and a woman named Anita Anand. And it's really about the history of empire broadly. The first season is going to be about the British Empire. And it's just a remarkable deep dive through the history of the British occupation of India, deep dives on like the Koh i Noor diamond, which is the diamond that sits in Queen Elizabeth's crown taken from India during that period. It is deep and rich and fascinating and just an unbelievably interesting view through a time that, you know, you may have read about in school, but really these stories bring it to life. So my best idea this week, a podcast, Empire, hosted by William Dalrymple and Anita Anand. Vikas, I think you'd enjoy it. It's right up your alley.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the recommendation.
All right. With that, it's time to wrap up for the week. VK, always great to catch up, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Colbert.
Thanks again to our guest, Vikas Keswani. Check out our show notes to learn more about Vikas and his role at HPS. You'll also find a link to my best idea, The Podcast Empire by William Dalrymple and Anita Anand. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.